The number of alcohol-related deaths here is at a record high, according to figures obtained by BBC News NI. Between 2001 and 16, more than 3,500 deaths in Northern Ireland were attributed to alcohol. That's more than four a week on average. This morning, we open up the lines to you. 03030 80 55 55. GP Dr. George O'Neill is chair of Addiction NI. My goodness, George, thousands of people losing their lives to drink.
Absolutely, Stephen. And I mean, alcohol kills three times more people than drugs, yet we tend to hear about drug deaths all the time, but yet we do not hear about alcohol deaths. And the other big difficulty is we have a serious alcohol problem here in terms of consumption and also the impact it has on health, on family, and on the wider society. And the cost is almost $1 billion. That's one-tenth of the block grant. When you add up the cost of the health service, the cost of the PSNI, the justice system, the criminal system, and you also look at employment, presentism and absenteeism at work. Addiction and I have a scheme called Drink, Work and Me, and we did a survey on workplaces, and we found that 1 in 20 in the workplace are there still under the influence. 1 in 10 have negative feelings about their alcohol behaviour. 1 in 5, they find that they're drinking at a significant level. 1 in 4, it impacts on their family, the hidden harm, the children who live in homes where there is alcohol abuse. And 1 in 3 people that we did the survey felt the need to cut down. So we have a significant and growing problem.
Is it any worse here than elsewhere in the UK?
No, this goes right across, but we are worse than probably, we're certainly not as bad as Scotland. I don't have the figures at my fingertips, but I don't think we're as bad as England and Wales when you look at the number of deaths per 100,000 of the population. But these deaths have increased 26% in the last decade. And the number of people admitted to hospital, that's not the number of people attending an emergency department, is about 12,000 a year. There was, and there still is, a difference between the number of males and females, but the females are gradually increasing in numbers. The other thing that Addiction NI has picked up is that there is a significant number of people in the sort of over 55, over 65 age group who are slowly, quietly at home, causing themselves significant harm by drinking. And this is the relation to loneliness, a bereavement, redundancy, social isolation. And they are sitting quietly at home, whereas we tend to hear with alcohol, we tend to hear about the Dublin Road or the centre of our big cities, where there's violence triggered by the disinhibition caused by alcohol. So this is a powerful and dangerous drug, and we need to get that message across. And I think it is timely for the coroner to raise the awareness.
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes we have this image in our mind of people with drink problems sitting in a bar. A large part of the problem, George, is people sitting at home, and they slip into a routine. Maybe they took a drink on a Saturday night when they're sitting with their husband or their wife or whatever, and that, as time has gone on, has turned into 2, 3, and then 4 and 5 nights a week, and then it's a problem.
And also the pattern of drinking has changed. There's this, but certainly the young people, preloading before they go out. So they would be able to buy alcohol, which is very, very cheap in an off-licence. You drink beforehand and then you go out afterwards. So there's a change in the pattern of the way we're drinking, changing the amount we're consuming. I mean, alcohol has never been cheaper. And I mean, there's a suggestion that we should bring in minimum unit price like they have in Scotland. And I think that will certainly help the hazardous drinker and the harmful drinker, because they tend to buy the cheaper alcohol.
How do people hide it? Do they hide it well?
Oh, I mean, lots of people, and that's the difficulty. There, people can function topping up constantly. And and what happens then is something happens. They're stopped when they're driving. There's an injury at work. They injure themselves at home. And then it becomes apparent. And quite often you would see notes from the emergency department when the people attended, alcohol on board is added to the clinical examination. And maybe that's the first presentation that there's an issue or a problem. So we have to raise the profile. We have to raise awareness. And Addiction NI, it's a community-based charity. And we're there to help people deal with their alcohol problems. We're there to try and find out the underlying issues, to increase their knowledge about the impact and the risks of alcohol. and identify any key triggers. And there are often triggers in a number of people. There's a dual diagnosis. Addiction NI is a member of a bigger mental health charity called Inspire. And the two, we work hand in hand, because quite often there's a mental health issue and there's an alcohol problem as well. We have a challenge in our justice system and prisons, where there are people who are in for alcohol or drug problems, and then they're discharged without any proper backup in the community. So it's a big, big issue. It's also a very challenging, problematic area, and often not very rewarding. It's difficult. There's a lot of failures, but we've had a lot of successes, and I hope some of them will contact your program this morning and explain there is light at the end of the tunnel, that there can be, there is help out there if they make the right approach to it.
I'm presuming, George, that this affects all different classes, all different backgrounds, all different walks of life.
It does indeed, but there's one stark figure that stands out. If you're a male and you come from a deprived area, you're five times higher to have an alcohol problem than someone who comes from a more affluent area. Now, that may be because it is more apparent, you're not as good at hiding it, but that is the stark reality, five times more. And you're more likely to die of an alcohol-related problem if you come from a deprived background. So there's a whole range of issues here, Stephen. And I think we have to address it, face up to it, and accept it. And I mean, you think of everything we do, there's alcohol behind it. Parties, christenings, birthdays, weddings, funerals, family gatherings, Christmas. There's all alcohol to it. Now, I'm not against people drinking alcohol, but provided they do it within the recommended 14 units of alcohol a week, which is not a lot. But when you think of the number of people who consume vast amounts, 51 units, 100 units, 200 units a week, these people are damaging themselves both mentally and physically. And the number of diseases related to alcohol, it covers the whole range from liver disease to heart disease to cancers to type 2 diabetes and to mental health issues.
George, thank you. 03030 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. 81771 on the text. Eamon Foley with us today. Good morning to you, Eamon.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. You were a homeless street drinker.
That's true.
How did it get to that stage, Eamon? What's your story?
Well, I was actually very close to being one of those statistics of the 3,500 that died. I started off very young at 13, 14, and it was the odd night out, and it progressed as I got older. There was more nights out, and then, as the previous caller stated, it started to be more affordable to drink at home or on the street, and it led to daily drinking. And at the end of my drinking, I was topping up constantly from the moment I woke up till the moment I passed out.
By what age?
13, 14, I started drinking. I grew up in a working class housing estate in the Strabane, which is a deprived area.
And the people around you, when you're drinking at 13 and 14, how are they not noticing it?
They were the same age, but I started moving away from younger friends as I drank more to hanging about with older friends who would have been able to afford to drink more.
And at what age did you reach a crisis, Eamon?
I was 36 when I was admitted to Alt McGalvin Hospital, and I had renal failure, and everything was shutting down, and I was given 48 hours to live, and I ended up with cirrhosis of the liver. It's a miracle I walked out of that hospital, but I made it.
And what was your life like in the years to the run-up of that crisis point? What was your pattern during the day?
My pattern every day was, I lived near an off-licence. I didn't really go out anywhere apart from to get drink. I needed drink to focus on anything at all. Alcohol ruled my life. I was drinking as the cheapest and strongest drinks I could get.
Were you working?
No. At the end of my drinking, I hadn't worked for a long time.
And you would have got up in the morning, how early would you start drinking?
As soon as the shakes hit you, it could be 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock if you're lucky.
In the morning?
In the morning. Sometimes it'd be 5 o'clock.
What would you have taken first thing in the morning?
I would always try and have a 3-litre bottle of Frosty Jack for the morning, for when I woke up, and
cider,
I was shaking uncontrollably and dry retchings thrown up, and there was nothing there, and trying to hold the drink down. Just as long as you got a bit in you, that would settle you down, and once you were settled down, that would be you for the day.
When you're drinking as a compulsion, as an addiction, do you enjoy it? Do you actually taste it anymore?
I would say you've lost the enjoyment a long time ago. It's become a necessity. You need it as much as you need oxygen.
And what would happen if you couldn't get any?
Well, I had done a stint in rehab, and I was quite aware that the repercussions of me not drinking and going cold turkey was I could have a fit and die.
And did you ever experience that, Eamon?
Unfortunately, I never had any fits, but as I say, it did get a grip on me in other ways, and I'm left now. I have cirrhosis, and I have to live with that for the rest of my life.
How does that affect you now?
Mine's is composite, which means it works. I'm very fortunate, and I have hospital appointments up at the Royal constantly. They're checking me all the time. One of the most common things they check me for is cancer. I'm at very high risk of cancer now.
Really? As a result of cirrhosis of the liver?
Yes.
Wow, okay. That's really interesting. How does that? I know you're not a medical professional, but do you know why?
It's just the damage that I've done over the years, the amount of alcohol I've drank. It's just left me that I'm at a higher risk of getting cancer. So my blood's checked 4 times a year, and I get an ultrasound of my organs 2 times a year. And every year I get an endoscopy. They put a camera down my throat, and all the time they're checking for lesions and growths, and it's just something that I have to live with every day and every year.
I think as we go through life, I don't know about everybody else listening to the programme today. Let's find out on the phones. But, you know, we're all susceptible to different addictions, aren't we?
Oh, we definitely
There's so many landmines as you walk through life that, I've been caught by food, clearly, all right?
Yeah.
And a bad diet, and that's probably really harming me. And yours was alcohol. And I'm just aware, as people are listening to this, that they will know what their vice is. They will know what is really harming, stroke killing them.
Yeah, knowing it's one thing, but the compulsion's sometimes stronger than the brain.
How did you stop?
As I say, I presented myself at Alt McGalvin, and I went into unconsciousness, and when I came round, I was told I had 48 hours to live and that I was do not resuscitate. I couldn't walk, I couldn't talk, and I couldn't eat, and everything was shutting down. I had total renal failure, and by a miracle, I learned how to walk, and after about 2 months in hospital, I was allowed to leave hospital. But as I say, I have hospital care now for the rest of my life.
You were in there for 2 months?
Yeah.
Wow. I so admire people that can break their addiction. I really do.
Thank you.
And I hope you're okay.
Yeah. I'm not passionate about this subject now that I'm currently doing a foundation degree through Ulster University in responding to the misuse of alcohol and drugs, because it's something I want to work with in the future. I want to help other people.
Thanks for talking to us this morning, Eamon. Morning to you. David next. Morning, David.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Morning. First of all, thank you to all of you that are calling us today. I know this is personal, and I appreciate your trust in the show. What's your story, David?
I was just saying to one of your researchers that I started drinking from probably around 16 or that, and growing up, it was like a rites of passage where alcohol was pretty normal, but and I guess my drinking wasn't pretty normal, though. I was drinking to blackout from an early age, and I had a fairly comfortable background, but I found myself drinking with street drinkers because my peer group weren't drinking that way, so I would end up drinking Silver Crown wine with street drinkers and at the weekend, which continued for a period of time. But as a result of the drinking, ended up in dramas and ended up in front of the courts and going to Young Offender Centre for violence, etc., etc. But I had underlying issues in the background in which alcohol was allowing me in my own head to escape from, but the alcohol was creating its own problems.
And do you want to share with us what those were?
I guess to enable me to retain some form of anonymity without saying too much about myself, if you know what I mean, but I had issues at school which happened. There was physical abuse, etc., etc., and I guess I just wasn't happy, you know. I wasn't happy with my perception of my reality. And I wasn't able to deal with it. I wasn't the sort of person who would talk to people about it. So bottled things up, and then I contained a lot of anger and a lot of frustration. And then whenever I drank, that would come out, you know. It ruined successive relationships, you know. And over the years, you know, you learn to live with it in so much as you work, you have relationships, et cetera, et cetera. But in the background, you still have the spectre of alcohol, you know.
Can I share something with you, David? I'm probably going to share this. Well, obviously, I'm sharing it with everyone. Uh-huh. People often wonder when they speak to me. I drink probably once or twice a year maximum, as in two nights. And they wonder why. And the reality for me is, because I eat so much, I'm terrified of developing the same type of addiction to alcohol.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm terrified of it, actually.
And I can totally understand that. You know, it's another way of changing your feelings, you know, as food, whenever we eat, we get a feel-good factor from that, you know, and we can become lost in that. The same with alcohol. But for many years, I've used drugs to control my alcohol, in so much as I didn't like the feeling of being out of control, you know, doing things I didn't really want to do. So I thought, oh, let me use certain drugs. Should it be speed? Should it be cocaine? So I could drink and sort of be sort of half corpus mentis. But I think I've worked with an addiction for quite some time, and I understand, you know, the issue is not so much the substance, the issue is what's going on in our head that leads us to want to escape from our reality, you know.
What was your lowest moment?
My lowest moment, you know, I guess towards the end, I had my partner, my children were home. I was working, you know, so things seemed to be okay, but inside I was a shell. And I was going through counselling therapy at this time, which was poured upon as a result of drink driving. That time then the alcohol was no longer working. You know, I was drinking to try to escape the feelings, the emotions that was coming up as a result of the therapy. But I just found myself going further and further and further down, you know, and I got to talk about the jumping off point, you know, where I don't quite content to have died, but I didn't have the courage to take my own life. But I didn't mind the fact I was killing myself with the amount of alcohol I was consuming. You know, I started using other substances as well because the alcohol was no longer working. And that was when I got to the precipice, you know, whenever the alcohol stopped working. And well, what do you do now?
Is it easy to hide, David? Is it easy?
I guess I'm not sure about easy to hide. At certain stages of my life, it would have been easier to hide because it wouldn't have been so obvious. But it depends on the company you keep, and it depends on your functionality. You know, yes, you could function to a certain extent, but not all the time. There would be glimpses of the problem there from time to time. So you could hide it, yes, you could disguise it some of the time, but every now and again there would be some evidence of it, you know, if you knew what to look for.
You know, I've seen it in some of my friends. I've seen it in some people around the BBC where you just have, well, you just have this worry about them when you see them. How can I explain this? It seems to always be there. So they can't they can't go out for a night without wanting to drink.
Uh-huh.
It's not as if they're drinking for pleasure. It's every time.
And I guess whenever you don't know when they stop drinking as well, you know, you never want the party to ever end. And that's part of the problem. But the most difficult thing, Stephen, is it's actually the degree of denial that exists. You know, to make a suggestion, to try to point it out to someone, you could get quite quickly rebuffed. You know, and that's the hardest thing to challenge is the denial. You know,
I had a close friend who it's some years ago now. She was a complete alcoholic. She was, you know, she was in a terrible state. And she beat it. She was able to completely beat her addiction. And I think I said at the top of the show, I so admire that because I know how difficult it is having listened to people's stories over the years. And when's the last time you had a drink, David?
It would be 14 years ago on the 16th of August.
Wow.
A couple of days away from that. Mm-hmm.
You proud of yourself?
I guess it's a difficult one because of, you know, the carnage of your past. You know, can you really be proud of yourself? I guess I'm living now as I should have been living in the first place, if you know what I mean, Stephen. So, but at one level, I do acknowledge the anniversaries of my clean time that has more significance to me than my birth, if you know what I mean, my birthday. Because it's something that's achieved, it's something that I had to work at to get, you know.
There's just different pressures on us all in life, isn't there? And I guess we resort to some type of comfort to get us through whatever pressures we're under, either long term or there's a big life changing moment, and maybe that's a trigger for people to turn to drink or drugs or sometimes sex or whatever it is. This overuse of something, and I'd love to talk to a psychologist about what that's all about.
And I wonder if, because everybody's going to be different, you know, you will have. Whenever we go through school, whenever we go through life, how many of us are given actually the coping skills to deal with feelings, to deal with emotions?
It's a really good point, actually.
You know, it's not anything that's actually taught. So whenever we have situations to deal with, if we don't have the tools in the background, we're susceptible to turn into a substance or a behaviour or whatever. But whenever alcohol is so freely available and you drink and you find, I no longer worry. I no longer feel as if I can't fit in. I can socialise. It's a social lubricant, you know. And then so all of a sudden you sort of, in inverted commas, feel normal for the first time. That's the danger.
What do you say to Pat, who emails me this morning, David?
Uh-huh.
And he says, Stephen, I'm very much in favour of addicts being given all the support available. However, I do not think the treatment of alcoholism should take preference over other conditions. The man who you interviewed at the beginning of the show seems to get regular hospital appointments, scans and endoscopies. Why can't I? I am not an alcoholic.
Uh-huh. You know, I worked in drug and alcohol treatment for over 10 years, and in all of that time, we've buried more people through alcohol than we have through drugs, you know, and the reality being, it's difficult to treat someone if they don't want to be treated, first and foremost. You know, you can have the best service in the world, but if that individual is at a point where they don't want to stop, they're not going to stop. But there does have to be the same options there for everybody, you know.
Appreciate you calling, David.
Thank you very much for your time, Zayden.
Thank you. Good morning. I think we can widen the show out today, can't we, into what we turn to. And there are people calling us, and thank you for doing so, who want to share their stories of alcoholism with us. But there are other things, as I was saying to David there, which we turn to in life as a comfort. And if we can all share those stories with each other this morning, maybe it'll help. Maybe it'll help us understand that you're not alone in whatever it is you're going through. And that sounds a wee bit cheesy, doesn't it? But I mean it. 0330 80 55 55. The journalist Tim Hedgley with us today. Good morning to you, Tim.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning. You gave up drink on what, 4th of January?
Yeah, I gave it up for a different reason. My daughter was due to get married in the summer, and I, like you, am no stranger to good feed. And I sort of was aware of this dry January month for cancer. And I thought to myself, I'm in a position where you're out with the media quite a lot, and you're at gigs and events, and all, and alcohol plays a fairly big part in the wider media circle. So I decided I would go off for January to raise some money for cancer awareness. And when I got to the end of the month, I realized that I'd lost weight, and I had primarily decided to lose weight, obviously, for the wedding photographs, and thought to myself, you know what, I actually am going to have to take a conscious decision to go back and have a drink. And I think drinking wasn't necessarily a problem for me, but what was an issue was getting the munchies. If you have a couple of glasses of wine, you want a packet of peanuts, or you want some chips or whatever, and then the next morning sometimes you would be inclined to go for fried food and stuff like that. So I thought to myself, let's try this. And I tried it, and I started to see the weight starting to come off. I've now lost 2 stone 10 pounds.
Wow.
Which for me was fantastic.
That's incredible.
But it came, one of your gentlemen earlier on there mentioned specific events, birthdays, anniversaries, and he mentioned weddings. Well, my daughter did get married in July, and I'd stayed off the drink because I found that the health benefits of staying off it. And somebody said, but you're going to have a drink for your daughter's wedding. And I went, why? And there seems to be a social perception where you must have alcohol at a celebration. And I said, I carry a drink bottle. It's a litre bottle. And I would drink now around about 4 litres of sparkling water and fruit juice every day.
Have you been in those situations? I wonder how many people can identify with this. You know, I know people who have been trying to come off the drink, and they've said, right, I'm not drinking when I go out. And the rest of the people that are out are kind of, you know, slapping them on the shoulder or whatever. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? You're not drinking. You know, it's a contradiction. You know, the drink's not good for you, but what's wrong with you? You're not drinking.
Well, I noticed.
Are you on antibiotics? Many times have we heard that. Are you sick?
I noticed at my daughter's wedding, you know, I had my bottle of juice, and the toast was coming about. And a niece of mine said to me, are you going to have a glass of champagne, Uncle Tim? And I said, no, I'm off the drink. And the response was, oh, I'm really sorry. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. And I went, I'm fine. I just choose not to drink anymore, because the fact that I'm losing so much weight by not drinking and not getting the munchies and doing all those stupid things. So for me, the benefits of not drinking outweigh the benefits of having a glass or two of wine and then wanting to go for crisps and kebabs and all the stuff that everybody does of a weekend. You know, when, as the Northern Irish term it, you get the load on. But I must admit, one of the things that really did scare me about that, I'm coming up towards 60, but whenever I was a youngster, you used to go out to the pub for a drink. But this thing about, well, I would call them children, young people now going out and preloading, they actually get drunk to go out, whereas my generation went out and had a few beers, and on the odd occasion you got drunk. But it's a worrying thing that kids are now drinking a bottle of vodka before they go out of an evening. Like, that's scary stuff.
Crazy.